And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
So, hello, good morning. You're very welcome along to a very special 9 to Noon Show. I suppose here in Brussels, it's the 10 to 1 show because we are an hour ahead here. We're live from the EU Parliament in Brussels, and we're going to be discussing all things EU, how the Parliament work, what's it do, what's its future like. And maybe you've got some questions in relation to that. As I say, we have a whole host of guests coming up over the next 3 hours. The usual numbers apply, 086 60 25000, WhatsApp or text that number, 086 60 25000. You can give us a call on 07491 25000, 07491 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. And if you wish to watch the show, you can watch us live here from Radio Studio 2, I believe it is, here in Brussels, by going to our socials, YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, or across our Facebook pages, and also on our website, highlandradio.com. Right, let's have a look at the papers. We're doing this a little bit different this morning, so hopefully it works okay. We'll start with news that Justice Minister Simon Harris has said plans to overhaul Ireland's defamation laws will stop if it acting as a rich man's law. Under the proposed new laws, juries would be abolished from High Court defamation cases. There's also a provision to allow a plaintiff or defendant to lodge an offer of settlement, which will be taken into account in defamation costs. That is an area that still needs looking at. The Irish Daily Mail this morning: the Defence Forces barely tolerates women members. A damning new review into allegations of bullying, abuse and harassment in the military is found. The report uncovered a litany of criminal and deviant behaviour that women in the army were subjected to over four decades, which Taoiseach and Defence Minister Micheál Martin said left him with a degree of disgust. Now, regular listeners to the show would know we've talked about women who have been in the army and have subjected to this type of experience, and it is unpleasant, and it's welcomed to hear that it's being acknowledged now, but we just have to see what happens going forward. The review conducted by an independent panel of experts found that the Defence Forces barely tolerates women, and it's worst verbally, physically, sexually and psychologically abusing women in its ranks. Okay, so that is the Irish Daily Mail this morning. Let's see what else is making the front pages. Excuse me. At 8:57 a.m. on Monday, Audrey Elizabeth Hale sent a friend a disturbing farewell message, issuing a dark warning that something bad is about to happen. This is the story of a chilling farewell message a killer sent to friend minutes before shooting spree. This is the awful story from the United States. Minutes later, the 28-year-old transgender ex-pupil embarked on a bloody gun rampage at a Christian elementary school for children as young as three in Nashville, Tennessee. Chilling CCTV footage shows the heavily armed shooter in camouflage trousers and a tactical vest blasting through a locked door at the convent school before stalking the corridors. And can you allow yourself to imagine what those young students must have been going through in that awful, awful moment? But unfortunately, and we were talking about this yesterday evening, it's hard to get your head around that it happens so regularly, and it really, really does. And it's such a polarising topic in the United States. Still, they seem no further to a solution that might see children not being gunned down in a place where they should be incredibly safe. Housing, of course, continues to dominate the headlines. Running scared over Dáil eviction ban vote is another headline. The government is expected to win another two votes in the evictions ban tonight, but there were angry scenes. Well, I think it's later this morning, actually, at least one of them. But there were angry scenes in the Dáil yesterday when the first motion on the contentious issue was debated after Sinn Féin introduced a motion calling for the ban to be extended. The main opposition party was denied the chance of a vote on their proposal when the government introduced a counter-move known as reasoned amendment, which stops the vote on the main issue going ahead. Last night, Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson Eoin Óibrín accused the government of running scared by attempting to suppress tonight's vote. Sparks are also expected to fly this morning when a formal motion of no confidence referring specifically to the eviction ban is tabled by Labour. The government's hoping to win both motions after beating a similar motion last week by 15 votes, but how deep will they have to dig to buy the support of the independents, I wonder. It emerged last night, late last night, that the margin of victory on the motion of no confidence may be narrower than anticipated by the government, as many independents are indicating that they will now abstain in the vote. If the coalition does lose tonight's vote, the government will fall. Sinn Féin had tabled legislation that would extend the eviction ban, which is due to lapse on Friday, until January 2024. However, the government said the Dáil declined to give the bill a second reading, as it had already agreed to end the eviction ban on March 31st at a cabinet meeting. And I heard one of the government representatives criticising the wording of the motion from Sinn Féin, which was, to all intents and purposes, the exact same as the government's own motion or own legislation, but without with a different date. Right, on to the Mirror now. The family of brave pit bull attack victim Alexandro Mizan have hailed new laws cracking down on dangerous dogs, saying it should help ensure no one else will suffer like he did. The devastating injuries suffered by the 10-year-old last year sparked a fresh review of rules in place surrounding dogs. Yesterday, the government approved new proposals to double fines under the Control of Dogs Act from €2,500 to €5,000. At least 40 new dog wardens will also be hired, along with other measures being put in place. And that is critical, because there's no point having the laws and the regulations if there's no fear of them being enforced. And that's where we are at the moment, I think. So more dog wardens has to be welcomed. Who's behind this? It's Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnell-Logue, who also sought backing from colleagues for recommendations from a working group examining dangerous dogs to increase fines. Alexandro spent 7 weeks in Crumlin's Children's Hospital undergoing treatment after being mauled in his housing estate in Enniscorthy, County Wexford, on November 27th. But do you think that actually goes far enough? I mean, we've heard calls locally before in the past, haven't we, that really there should be like a test or a bar that you must reach before you can own a dog. 086 60 25,000, if you want a view on that. Now, we went through Dublin Airport yesterday. Pretty cool, no problems, plain sailing. But it might be different when it's busier. Dublin Airport has unveiled a 15-point master plan. Sounds ominous, doesn't it? To make journeys more pleasant. The changes include less clutter, new eateries, faster Wi-Fi and a dedicated family zone. It's aiming to get the majority of passengers through security in less than 20 minutes and has vowed a better taxi experience and more bus options. There'll be a major focus on making the airport cleaner, with an extra 1,500 cleaning hours as well as 120 cleaning inspections every day. Well, let's see how that pans out. We wish them well in their endeavours. We're on the road to ruins. Another story in the papers today. Motorists are being hammered with soaring fuel prices, as almost one in four, that's 23% of us, report they're paying over €300 a month to fill the tank. Overall, more than half of motorists are paying more than €200 a month, as another 33% of those surveyed revealed they were spending between €201 and €300 a month. It all very much depends, of course, how much you use the car, doesn't it? And we in the Northwest are forced to. Let's just put it like that. We don't have alternatives. So we are invariably going to be in the higher scale of that average. And still, persistently, and I noticed yesterday, there are massive variations in different parts of the Northwest. In Letterkenny, you can get petrol in the low 50s, 150s, like 154, 155. The further south you go, 168. Still don't understand exactly what the difference is between two parts of the same county, but anyway. Anyway, these price increases have led to 7 out of 10 drivers to say fuel is now the top financial concern when it comes to running a car. The same percentage also say they are cutting back on driving because of the exorbitant price of fuel. Again, 086 60 25,000, if you wish to have a say in that. Enoch Burke was back in court yesterday. I was watching some of the live tweeting. The judge in this instance seemed to not want to take any of his shenanigans, can we put it like that? A brother of sacked school teacher Enoch Burke pleaded not guilty yesterday to a breach of peace in connection with the outbursts in the Court of Appeal. Simon Burke is 24, though he looks much younger. A barrister at law said, or he told Clover Hill District Court, "We are not in North Korea, Judge. We are to be thrown into a cell and not to be told. And it's cut off there, I can't see, but I think you get the gist of it here. Let me see, I can pick it up here. He remains in custody and said yesterday that he should have been sitting his drafting exams in King's Inn as he demanded a speedy trial and accused Gardaí of telling lies. He will learn his hearing date today. The student had been arrested following chaotic scenes where Gardaí intervened in the Court of Appeal in the four courts after a judgment was handed down in teacher Enoch Burke's case on March 7th. But he himself was in court yesterday as well. What do you think about this story relating to Kerry Harrington, Kelly Harrington? She issued an apology yesterday, I believe, after she was caught off guard in an off-the-ball interview. It's off the basis of a tweet she sent. Kelly Harrington, we read, has said she does not want to engage in politically sensitive matters after being grilled about a deleted social media post. Boxer Kelly, 33, refused to answer questions during an interview on News Talk's Off the Ball about a tweet she shared last October. The Olympic gold medalist retweeted a video from GB News 5 months ago, which featured Dutch commentator speaking on the death of a 12-year-old girl in France. In the clip, the commentator said, "I woke up this morning to see the news of another young European girl who was sacrificed on the altar of mass migration. We have four people in custody, all migrants coming from Algeria." Harrington commented at the time, "Very, very sad, a powerful message from Ivar Vladinger Broek. Our own leaders should take a listen." Now, after that interview, she was subjected to an awful lot of negativity, of course. I don't know, maybe she should have been engaged in a different platform subsequently to try and tease out her views, maybe give her a better understanding, give her an opportunity to speak. I don't know, I just am not fully comfortable with one wrong seeming to be addressed by another wrong where someone is completely and utterly wiped out. But anyway, if you have any views on that, 086 60 25,000. Dissident Republican terrorists are desperate for a kill. It was warned yesterday in the wake of the MI5 raising the terror threat level. The spy agency increased the threat from substantial, where an attack is likely, to severe, where one is highly likely. The reasons behind that we don't necessarily know. On to the locals now, and I believe this is the Inishowen Independent. The Inishowen woman who lost her father and nephew in a boating accident off the Malin Head has called for public inquiry into maritime safety and for the immediate implementation of recommendations made at the inquest into the deaths. Donna Marie Keenan from Burt lost her 63-year-old dad, Jerry Doherty, and her 16-year-old nephew, Thomas Weir, when their 19-foot boat capsized off Malin Head on July 17th. You can read more about that in the paper, of course. Let's see, where else are we? Yeah, I've just read that one. And lastly, did you see, I think it's lastly, actually we'll just stick with this story for now, because the Donegal company at the centre of the defective block scandal has been given 2 months to decide whether to contest a case over its non-compliance with planning conditions. Donegal County Council has brought legal proceedings against Cassidy Brothers Concrete Products Limited. The company's been given until the end of May to either plead guilty or fight the case. Right, okay. I think that's about it, isn't it? There are more stories we'll get to as the morning wears on. 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60 25,000. You can give us a call on 074 91 25,000. We've got a whole load of guests coming into studio over the next couple of hours. We'll also be talking about a conference on the Good Friday Agreement taking place here in Brussels later today, which we're hoping to attend. So if you have any questions, any comments about EU matters, how the impact you do you feel the impact you do you feel disconnected? Maybe you feel connected. I don't know. I don't want to put thoughts or words in your mouth. Not that I have that ability, of course. 086 60 25,000. That's WhatsApp and text number. Give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Comments to via email to comments@highlandradio.com. And if you want to watch the program, our guests are about to join us now. Get onto our social media. Watch us live from Brussels. Our YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, across our Facebook pages, on our website. Click Watch Live. Get involved there. We want you on board. Okay, the time is 18 minutes past 9 in Ireland. Here where we're sitting at the moment, it is 18 minutes past 10. Right, we're joined in our studio here now by MEP Luke Ming Flanagan, an independent, and also Johan Wake, European Integration, International Trade Law and Policy. Is that it? Yes. And Arab, Gulf States and European Union. That's it. I got there in the end. Okay, before we get on to all matters European, Luke, any update on the EU's role in the defective concrete crisis in Donegal at the moment in terms of any moves that they may be inclined to make? Or I think there's visits upcoming. I'm not sure. I don't want to spring that on you. Are you across that at the moment? Just
excuse me, Greg. Last Thursday, the Petitions Committee of the European Parliament, which the Mike Action Group made a presentation in front of a couple of years ago and impressed them. A petition was kept open, and last Thursday, basically at the Petitions Committee, at the coordinators meeting, where they decide what that committee is going to be doing for the next 6 months, my group put in a request that they visit Donegal. They call it a mission, to use the Brussels speak. We didn't expect the group to agree to it because there was a couple of other applications in to go to Spain, etc. But thanks to the left MEP, Sira Riga, they have agreed to come to Donegal. So that means, from the point of view of the people who have their houses basically in this horrific position, it means that MEPs from that committee will actually come out and see them for themselves firsthand. And I know they've heard about them, and I had heard about them, but when you see them, I don't need to tell you, I've watched what you've been doing, I've watched your Twitter accounts. When you see them, you really, really get the idea of how horrific the situation is. So in October of this year, that committee is going to come out. It's going to look at what's happened. It's going to report back to the committee. From that, ideally, they will propose that infringement proceedings be taken against Ireland, and that they encourage the Internal Market and Consumer Affairs Commission to push this further. We also have a meeting, we're basically at the moment preparing a meeting with that same Directorate General of Internal of Consumer Affairs with the MICA group in the next couple of months. So at the moment, it's we're talking to them, and basically we're trying to have the maximum possible effect. But there is a quicker way around this, that the government actually do it. I would prefer if we didn't have someone coming over, observing and telling us the right thing to do, in the same way as the IMF did with our finances. But unfortunately, that's where we are. But this isn't going away, and the EU are now focusing on it.
Sorry, Luke, is this moral support, or might it actually progress things? Because the government will argue that we've put in place an enhanced scheme that is better than the one that went before it. You know, we're taking regulation and enforcement and all that much more seriously. What are you on about, Europe? What else do you want us to do here? They will be able to make that argument. So other than this being really very, very significant, do you think it progresses the plight of a frustrated homeowner listening to this programme this morning? And that's not in any way to put it down.
It's a very good question. And if you had asked me a year ago, I would have said the main role that I would have in this and the European Parliament would have in this is to shine a light on it and to put pressure on the authorities in Ireland. But I'm delighted to say they're actually taking it even more serious, because there are regulations out there within the European Union on standards for building materials. And to me and to the MICA Action Group, it's quite clear that these standards haven't been followed. And we have cross-party support on this. We have support from an EPP MEP called Peter Yar, who I work with on the Agriculture Committee. And I'll quote what he said. What is the point in having European rules and regulations if they're not enforced? So they are taking this seriously, and I have to say, more seriously than I thought they would. And I have to say, it has somewhat tempered my Euroscepticism. In fact, every week that I'm here, it is tempered somewhat.
Wow, that's worrying.
Well, you work on the basis.
You work on the basis of what you're presented with. Of course, you are.
If you see good things, you point it out. If you see bad things, like us putting more money into basically what is a European army called PESCO by another name, you oppose that. But if I see good things, I'm going to support them, because otherwise you're just a populist.
Right, okay, and thank you very much for the update in that. Right, so we have Brexit MEPs, they're no longer in the chamber here. But there does seem to be, now I'm not stating it as a fact, but there does seem to be a growing anti-EU sentiment. Far left, far right, they've got their own agendas in this regard. So, Johan, let me ask you, what do you believe the future of the EU looks like? Because even in Ireland and our own country, country. I wouldn't disregard the anti sort of EU Irexit movement, because you do that at your peril, I believe. Not that it's up for me to oppose them, don't get me wrong. What do you see for the future of the EU?
Well, it's hard to say. I would not really agree if there is an EU anti-sentiment. I think you should narrow it down to the nationalistic atmosphere, because what we see, especially since COVID, that people start to revolt in the sense that people say, OK, we are not happy with the lockdown. We are not happy that prices go up. Is this to be blamed to, let's say, the European Union? Because the European Union for the average EU citizen is not very visible. The treaties have outlined that there is EU citizenship, but the EU institutions, so to speak, are far away from the average you and me. So there should be, let's say, more information. I think the Brexit is basically due to two factors. There was populism, because Nigel Farage misinformed or ill-informed, if you see it like this, the public. So I think that the average Brexit voter already regrets that the UK is out of the European Union, because there were substantial benefits. Now they have, let's say, a different relationship with the European Union. We have seen that there were problems when the Brexit effectively took effect. But it is really also perhaps maybe a positive thing, and the Lisbon Treaty provided for this, because before there was never ever an exit clause. So a member could say, I would like to be in the European Union, but there was no possibility to go out. This is now tested, so this can create a precedent, let's say, for other member states. I don't see immediately that there is any member state who will exit the European
Union.
And
perhaps maybe the experience of the British is the greatest advertisement for staying in the EU?
I would say so, because the European...
You don't agree, Luke?
I think it's pretty much undeniable.
Yes, I think it's all gone to pot.
I think it's really an issue, like the European institutions should be more proactive. The Lisbon Treaty, or at least the Lisbon Treaty before, was voted down in the Netherlands and other countries. In France, they say the populace said no. Yes, in Ireland too, twice, I think. So in 2009, just before the ratification, I think the Irish had to have certain protocols, exceptions to it. But it's fairly important that the European citizen understands what the European Union is for, that this is not a federal supranational state. So this is not really moving in, let's say, a very centralized Brussels bureaucracy. There is still some influence by the member states.
Yeah, but can I just give you a typical example before I bring Luke in here? I think yesterday they got the ban on, petrol, diesel, internal combustion engines across the line yesterday. I think the Germans were holding out, but I understand that that now has been okayed from 2035, right? So if you're sitting in Ireland, right, you're in Donegal, you're in Roscommon or Leitrim, and you very much rely on your car, you say, you feel, right, that, well, that is Europe, that's Brussels now taking my ICE engine car off me. That's the relationship, it seems, that we have with Europe. Do you know what I mean? So whilst we might not understand everything that goes on, the headlines that come out always seem to be they're taking our fish, they're taking our cars. Do you think there's a role, maybe, I'm not saying that's the reality, or is it? I think people, governments, MEPs, whoever it might be, have to counteract that and talk more about the work that's done.
Well, it's definitely also an issue about, let's say, European integration. This is 27 member states who act and decide together. So what is probably good for one issue, like the Green Deal, is probably not so good for, let's say, what you mentioned here in terms of the motor industry. So there are lobby influences. There are all kinds of structures at work who try to best to get the best deal from European integration. It is also not so that the individual EU member states does not have an influence. This is a democratic institution. You can say there is a democratic deficit, but generally we are a democratic institution which is rule-based, and the public does have an influence either by direct or indirect elections, and they can participate. There is a civil dialogue.
Johan, thank you for that. Do you agree with that? I want you to come in
I just want to comment on the idea, this thing of the rise of the far right and the far left. Well, the first thing you've got to do is, what do you define as far left and what do you define as far right? Do you define far left as, now far left is described as saying people should have a house. Now far left is saying you should have a higher corporation tax of 12.5% when it was above 50% and above 60% in the United States of America during its most prosperous era in the 1970s. So to define what's far left nowadays in political science terms, the Overton window has moved extremely to the right. Mm-hmm. And what was considered a middle ground now is considered the extreme left. But from the point of view of the growth of the left and the right, I'd have to say, unfortunately, it would be incorrect to say that there has been a growth in the left. There has indeed been a growth in the right. Fine, in France, they did the left did quite well in the parliamentary elections. But in other countries, that is not the case. And it may well, it probably will happen in France in the European elections. But I don't see a rise in the far left within the European Union. From the point of view of the European Union having an influence, let's say for the people of Donegal, my most direct experience of how the European Union works is my participation in the Common Agricultural Policy Review. Now, people are probably a bit bored of me talking about it, but this is my core experience of dealing with the European Parliament and how the Parliament deals with Council and how they deal with the Commission in a trialogue. And what I can see is that from the point of view of Donegal, the European Parliament had a role in setting minimum amounts that farmers in Donegal would get, setting a minimum amount for the convergence of payments at 85%, whereas the Council wanted to set it at 70%. This was worth, and you can check out the figures, tens of millions of euros to the people of Donegal. Then there's another line in that text when it comes to peatlands and when it comes to carbon-rich soils. It's a thing called GAIAC 2. It is a provision that's put in there if you want to farm on those lands. We fought tooth and nail that a agricultural activity would be guaranteed, quote unquote, in that regulation. We got it in there. So it meant then that when the plans were put together at a national level, Charlie McConnell had no choice but to give a minimum of that amount of money to the people of Donegal. He had no choice but to take 10% of the overall cap budget and give it to the poorer farmers. We left him without a choice. He had a choice to go further. He didn't go further. But without what the European Parliament did and without the decision that we made, Donegal would be tens of millions of euros less well off. Mm-hmm. And finally, I was against the Lisbon Treaty, but look, you learn things as you go along in life. And in the Lisbon Treaty, because of the Lisbon Treaty, as an MEP who hitched to his first meeting, eventually got elected, became the representative for our group, the Left, became one of eight MEPs who got to negotiate basically a third of the European Union budget. It meant that we had actually a voice in the room. So while it isn't perfect, it's certainly better than not having a say. But I was disappointed given that most of the governments would have supported the Lisbon Treaty. During trialogue negotiations, they tried to deny it existed. They tried to deny us a voice. But we fought hard and we did get heard. But it wasn't because they wanted to listen to us. It was actually because they had no choice. And while I didn't support the Lisbon Treaty, the people who did support it then in the trialogues didn't actually support it there. I do support it now because it's there and that's the law. And we do have an influence. I didn't think we would. I wish we had more. But I have to say I was proved wrong and I'm delighted I was proved wrong.
Yeah, OK. And that's the voice there of MEP Luke Ming-Flanagan. We also have Johan Wake with us as well. We'll be back with more from our two guests and your questions coming into them on 086 60 25,000 or on 07491 25,000 after we take this quick break. Yep, OK. I think we are back live, are we? Yeah, we are indeed. We're just having a chit-chat here off air. My fault, of course. We're still in the company of our guests, Luke Ming-Flanagan, MEP, of course. What's the European view of what's happening in Ukraine? I'll start with you, Johan, or your view in that, you know, there is a sense as well in Ireland, and I'm sorry to talk about senses and stuff like about, you know, the feeling that there's an increase in the left and the right and all that type of stuff, but I just want to sort of, I want to try and capture the what people are feeling and the conversations we're having in our kitchens and front rooms. There is sort of a sense that Ireland's being dragged out of its neutrality, that, you know, there was a recent comment made by a senior government representative that talked about we need to have a conversation about our neutrality, but the position was as if it were to for us to get rid of it, right? As opposed to strengthening it? Or actually,
immature conversation. Don't forget that word, because apparently it's been immature up until now.
Right, well, we will always want a mature one, right? So I'm kind of conflating issues here too as well. But as well, Europe is very heavily invested in what's happening in Ukraine and backing Ukraine. What's your overview of what's happening, Johan, on a European perspective? And maybe we can get Luke's view on the Irish perspective then.
Well, there can be no doubt. There is definitely a moral obligation, not least from the European Commission, the Council, the European Parliament, because they created expectations. I'm not speaking about the statements which have been made immediately following the invasion of the so-called special operation of Vladimir Putin. But we have to be realistic. When the events already started in Ukraine in 2004, then it went back to 2014. And 2014, when Vladimir Putin invaded the Crimea, the world stood by. There was no intervention. So it was basically, okay, he can get away with it. That meant that the European Union did not really seize the momentum to create, let's say, on possibilities. There was an association agreement. This association agreement got some opposition in my own member states, which is the Netherlands. There was a kind of referendum, or at least there was a call for a referendum to block this. But the association agreement nevertheless went ahead. Now we see that this is there is no solution immediately in sight. This is going to be costly. Is it going to be costly for the average consumer? That is the key question, because the European institutions are very generous in donating money, because they stimulate that. The member states follow their advices. But what we see is that the average consumer is beginning to think. First, there was COVID, which prices went up. Salaries were a little bit, discussions for the trade unions. And then suddenly we have this war in Ukraine, which is very costly. The question now is, can Europe sustain this? Because we have a looming issue with the banking sector again. So everybody is now beginning to remember what happened in 2008, 2009. And now the consumer is beginning to say, okay, what is next? And this is a tricky situation, because we have spoken about far right, we have spoken about far left. All kinds of parties with a populistic angle will bank on this. And this might create a certain sentiment saying, okay, I can support the Ukrainians, but this year will be very decisive, because support will wane. It will definitely go down if there is no solution, because nobody is speaking really about peace, President Zelensky.
Yeah, but the EU is not exactly making any suggestions that it's keen to talk peace either, unless I've missed it. It just, all I hear is, you know, more and more weapons, more and more tanks. Are we going to send planes? You know, why do you think the EU would not be interested in maybe a negotiated settlement? Or that seems to be we even had the Ireland's Taoiseach premier saying that we need to stop Putin in his tracks. That's coming from a supposedly neutral country.
Exactly. If you remember well, everybody last year and the end of April was saying, OK, we have to watch carefully what Vladimir Putin is going to say on the 1st of May, because the 1st of May is a traditional national day in the Russian Federation. Everybody was expecting that Vladimir Putin was going to declare full war, because they were saying, OK, special operations will now become a full war. But it didn't happen. In fact, his speech on the 1st of May was pretty moderate. There would have been, let's say, an opportunity to say, okay, let's see this as a kind of opportunity to open some kind of back-channel negotiation, and not with a high-profile person like Emmanuel Macron, because he had a political agenda because of the French presidential election. But why not a person like Angela Merkel? She has a similar
background. There's a relationship
background,
there, isn't
a
there?
Relationship with Vladimir Putin. This could have created, let's say, a kind of opportunity.
But there's no appetite for that.
No, I think that it is fair to say that the European Union and the Americans would like to give Vladimir Putin, let's say, the final blow. They would like to wipe him out indefinitely and hope that the opposition...
That's very dangerous, though, because this is a person with access to extremely end-of-game weapons, effectively. I mean, and of course, too, you've got external parties as well looking on with great interest. This is draining the West, let me put it like that as well. I'm sure the Chinese are watching on with great interest, the North Koreans elsewhere, other members of BRIC, etc.
I think one of the problems in this conversation is, and I think what you said was really interesting and very instructive and informed, is that there's a lot of people who listen to you would immediately say, oh, you're being soft on Putin, as if that's going to solve the problem, saying that. But what you said makes a lot of sense. But to even have that conversation is difficult now, because it's this immediate thing. If you're talking about peace, right, you can't talk about peace because the Ukraine aren't the aggressor. We know they're not the aggressor. It's clear that Vladimir Putin is, whatever, describe him in every negative terms you want, he is a rotten individual. But saying that doesn't solve the problem. But what you've said there makes an awful lot of sense. But from the point of view of Ireland, like, what's Ireland's contribution to this? Like, what significant difference militarily can Ireland make? We can't make any difference, significant military difference to Ukraine here. So the idea that we get involved in that sense is silly, because we gain nothing and we lose something potentially when this war does come to the end, from the point of view of someone who can be a peace broker, someone who can
but
be talked
Luke, should
to,
we have
someone
done
who
that
can
without
negotiate
a conversation
it?
With the people? Because, you know, like, it does, obviously, we're
well,
not...
Sorry, but Greg, we have had the conversation with the people, and even after, and initially my thought was, oh my God, I'd nearly want to go out and fight myself, because when I seen the first pictures, I thought, Jesus, if that was my kids, I will do anything. But when you sit down and you rationally think about it, as the Irish people did, and then with all of that emotion there, if they're surveyed and asked, do you still want to remain military neutral? And I was shocked, but I was so proud of the people. They came back in 2/3 of them, and more said they wanted to remain military neutral. So the people of Ireland, even in the heat of this, in an emotional time, are still saying, no, it isn't that we don't want to help anyone. We want to do what's practical.
What
can Ireland
neutral?
Do
are you,
best?
Are you happy that we politically have picked a side?
Well, I think there is absolutely no harm in pointing out the bleeding obvious,
yeah,
that Vladimir
course, yeah.
Putin is an absolutely horrific individual, and so he what he has done is wrong. But from the point of view of us saying, our Taoiseach coming out saying pretty much that we need to eradicate him, what can Ireland do to make that happen? Absolutely nothing. Is saying it making it any more likely to happen? No. Is it making us any?
So what
is
should
it making
he have said,
us
Luke?
Any safer? No.
So what language would you like him to be using?
Well, he needs to use the language of, we need to find a negotiated settlement on this that the Ukrainian people are happy with, that basically brings an end to basically putting people through a meat grinder, which is what's happening now.
Like, it really is terrible. Like, and I'm thinking on young Russian men and women as well that probably don't know precisely what they're being sent into, like battling over a city of no consequence whatsoever, the incredible, incredible loss of life. And we're all funding that as well. And then it seems to be no effort at all to try and even to, you know, even if you mention a ceasefire, it's shut down by them saying, well, that's just going to give Putin a chance to regroup.
Yeah.
Do you know, you know what I mean? So even if
well,
you try
and... one of the questions you were asking, I think that you sent through to us was the amount of money that's been spent there. Is it money being well spent? And look, I can come on here and I can give you my opinion and say this and that about it. But as an MEP, I do have a role. I am a member of the Budget Control Committee. The Budget Control Committee, probably the dullest committee in the European Parliament, but probably the most important one. It looks at how every last cent of your money, all the people who are listening here, is spent. And at the last coordinators meeting, I'm a coordinator for our group on that committee, we discussed whether we would invite the Ukrainian Interior Minister into our committee to talk to them about how the money is being spent. Because remember, two things can be true. Vladimir Putin can be a monster. The Ukrainian people are going through hell. But it can also be true that there is a lot of corruption in Ukraine. And the European Court of Auditors have brought out a report. It's headed by a Dublin man, Tony Murphy, brilliant, one of the best European Union people I have met. And they have produced reports to show that there is massive corruption. We need to help the Ukrainian people, but we will help them more by scrutinising how that money is spent. So I'm hoping, and it looks like it will happen, that the Budget Control Committee will invite ministers from from Ukraine to explain to us exactly how the money is being spent, and that's a good forum to do it.
Okay, Johan, if you want to follow on from that, and then I'll ask you another question.
I would like to make a comment, because wasn't it so that Vladimir Putin was a little bit neglected? We have to go back to 2007. The story is not well known, but it is completely ignored by the discussion which we have since a year. In 2007, to my knowledge, Vladimir Putin spoke in Munich to the annual security conference. He was saying, like, okay, I see that the European Union is becoming a bigger entity in terms of membership. That was not a problem for him. But he said something like, they are also taking on board these countries as NATO members. Mm-hmm. So I see the NATO coming in my direction.
I just put to that, though, his invasion of Ukraine brings him closer to NATO.
Yes, but he said, kind of reaching out, we are living now in a post-Soviet era. We need to think about a new security structure. This was reaching out. The European Union and the United States of America should have capitalized on this. They should have recognized this kind of talk and saying, okay, maybe he is right, because we are not really exactly friends, but we need to figure out a new kind of structure. It didn't happen. So in 2008, Vladimir Putin tested the waters in Georgia, in Chechnya, Dagestan. Was there a reaction? Vladimir Putin saw there was no international reaction. Vladimir Putin said, okay, you never know what I can expect from the West. So he prepared for a war economy, which the European Union did not.
Mm-hmm.
So now we are speaking here about 70 billion euros. It's lost. It's gone. It's never going back. So could this have been prevented, let's say, in 2008-2009 momentum?
And not only that, Luke, would you agree to some extent, and this is in no way to back Putin as such, like, we can't ignore the fact that not only maybe did we not speak to him in the context Johan's talking about, but NATO, the West, America, Europe poked him. They poked the bear to some extent too.
Yeah, without doubt. I mean, if they're worried...
To what end, like, you know?
Well, to the end, to basically get rid of Russia, who they see as a problem forever and ever. But it was never going to be that simple. But all I know is it's an absolute and utter mess now.
How does it end, Luke, and before we take another quick break and then we'll move on to our final subject? How does this end? Because I don't see anyone really motivated for it to end, and we don't know where this might go.
At the moment, I don't see any end. I don't see any end to this. All I see is, from both sides, is that, as in, I don't mean from the Ukrainian side, but from the NATO side, from the US side, it's there can be no peace negotiations. We need to get them completely and utterly out of Ukrainian territory.
But that's never going to happen.
Even
never
though
come out
there's
of
a contradiction there in that they didn't go to war with them when they went into Crimea. But now a solution will have to involve them leaving Crimea. It seems like the standards are higher now that they've decided to go to war.
But you see, if Crimea were on the table, Putin, and listeners, a lot of it's about saving face. I presume he could make a very strong argument that in the east of Ukraine, he has achieved his set goals. Like, he could sell that he has. I mean, he's annihilated it. But if Crimea is not on the table, I don't see how any solution could be found. I'll ask the same question to you, Johan. Do you see an end to this, and if so, how?
Yes, I'm not pessimistic. We see that a new power broker is emerging on the world stage.
China?
Yes,
right.
We have seen that the Chinese have kind of brokered an agreement between the Saudis and the Iranians, and we still have to see how this is going to be played out. But it's well known, the world is moving to multilateralism, a multipolar with eventually a new center of gravity. Nobody was expecting that this would go violently, but it is not unlikely if it is not China. We have also seen that the King of Bahrain has recently proposed that he is willing to make an effort to bring the parties together, because we should be realistic. Zelensky has a peace proposal. Somebody has to capitalize on this, and we don't really know what is happening back channel wise.
Mm-hmm.
So if, let's say, the Europeans and the Americans can live with the idea that Vladimir Putin and Zelensky are going to sit together with, let's say, a neutral partner, because this is definitely about...
Okay, just let me ask you, right, let's just imagine... Right, that it's not actually Zelensky making the shots, calling the shots here, right? And he kind of would have to get some approval from Brussels or Washington. Will that be forthcoming? Like, is there a international appetite on this side, so to speak, for for an end to this effectively proxy war?
Maybe I see it wrong, but I think that Joe Biden gave a strong signal. We have seen this debate about towing more military equipment to the front lines. But this military equipment is usually only reserved for NATO partners because it has to do with a qualitative advantage on the front line. All of a sudden, these fighter jets needed to be downgraded because if they are going to be delivered, there is a risk that such a shootdown can deliver, let's say, Western technology to the Russians. This was not to the liking to certain countries. But then suddenly Joe Biden said, Zelensky does not need these fighter jets. So that is, in my point, the first observation that the Americans are willing to say, we are not going to deliver all kinds of weaponry at all costs.
But everyone hasn't suffered out of this either. There's an awful lot of ordinary people have suffered. But if you're involved in the fracking industry in the United States of America, if you're involved in exporting gas, I mean, it's been open season for them. And for those people who wanted to push back on moves to something about climate change, on biodiversity loss, we've had proposals from the European Union where we should grow grain on every last bit of environmentally friendly land that's there, because if we don't, we'll all starve. So lots of people have taken advantage of it, and now we have too much grain, but they haven't rolled back on that. We still have ignoring environmental concerns. So
I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll skip going to the break, and then I'll take a double head into 10, and then I can let you guys get on with your very busy agendas. You talked about corruption in Ukraine, and I'm not saying it's corruption as such, but there was quite a controversy. Qatargate, I think it was referred to here. You know, we were talking about that at home as well, because we only focus on the negative things, you see.
Well, can I tell you how I've seen it from...
Has the reputation of the EU been damaged, or is it damaged, or what?
Well, I didn't have an amazingly high opinion of the EU when I got elected in the first place anyway. So my opinion did go up, but this certainly didn't help. But I'll tell you from an MEP's perspective, sitting in the chamber, listening to an MEP that I thought was on the side of social justice standing up and saying, and at that time I was going, will I watch the World Cup? Can I watch this knowing what I know? And then I heard a particular MEP that I trusted stand up in the European Parliament and say, hold on a minute, you've got it wrong. There have been a lot of improvements when it comes to human rights in Qatar. When it comes to workers' rights, we are working on this. We are talking to these people. Things are changing. Now, I was looking for an out because I wanted to watch the World Cup. But I'll tell you straight, I left the chamber that day going, maybe I've got it wrong. I watched the whole of the World Cup. The guy who made the speech is currently in prison.
Right. What do you think? Did that damage the EU's reputation?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there is a certain sentiment where certain people begin to say, is the European Parliament more interested in blatant money-making rather than serious or credible law-making? That is definitely an observation.
You're going to have to answer that question. You can't pose it.
No, but there is definitely a perception in terms of image of the European Parliament. This is maybe also the reason why the Qataris sought access to the European Parliament, because in the Gulf there is another perception about wheeling and dealing. And wheeling and dealing and kickbacks is not unique to the Arab world. It's well known that Brussels has a reputation. There are more than 20,000 lobbyists around here. If you go on a Thursday evening here to Place Luxembourg, you can see them, you can meet them. But what are these people doing?
I don't know, but I want to get my hands on some of this EU money. What do I have to do? Who's do I have to sell my soul to?
Obviously, they don't rate me very highly because none of them have come to me. The only lobbyists who come to me are small scale farmers, small scale fishers, etc.
We should not be naive. I mean, everybody is focusing to the parliamentarians and to, let's say, other institutions and lobbyists. But isn't it so that European industrial world has a substantial interest in these countries? Because face the reality. We always speak in the European Parliament, in the Council, in the Commission. There is even a mandatory political dialogue and trade deals. Human rights, rule of law, fundamental freedoms, civil liberties. But the European industries, the builders who built the stadiums, the architects who designed these buildings, from which countries are they? So there is a kind of sentiment when the European Parliament says, okay, we have a co-decision on this or that proposed legislation. These lobbyists say, wait a minute, because we have an interest. We don't want this security on, let's say, the construction site. We don't want, let's say, restrictions in labor hours, these kinds of things, and the situation improved in the labor camps, because this is all about blatant money-making. You cannot blame the Arab Gulf states. It's also their responsibility, also from, let's say, a European perspective, because we have a vested interest in economic scene.
Okay, I think people get that.
Look, there's talk of cooling off periods after people stop being MEPs. I think that should be extended to 2 years. I think it should also be there
cooling
for parliamentary...
Cooling off from going off working
in industry that you had previously made decisions on, potential regulation and legislation. And likewise for parliamentary assistance. You can have someone working on an environmental file one day, and then you can have them working for the oil industry the next day. You can have someone working on the Econ Committee in the European Parliament as an MEP from Ireland, and then you can have them working on behalf of the Irish banking.
Or you can have someone working for the Road Safety Authority one day, and then working for insurance companies the next. It happens all over the place.
That shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, Lukeman Flanagan, MEP, thank you so much for calling into us. Johan, thank you so much as well. It's been really interesting for me to get your insight. Johan Wake, I beg your pardon.